You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War, Summary Episode 2, Germany Prepares for War. Summary episodes are where I take an entire series of episodes and condense them down into a single episode to help bring important information back to the forefront before it is needed. In this case, this episode is being released before the episodes on the invasion of France. If you want to hear far more about the topics that I'm about to discuss, you can go back to listen to episodes 78 through 84, which were released in January and February of 2002. The original episodes were focused on Germany's path towards war, and what the German military was planning to do in the coming conflict. This was a critical time for the later events of the Second World War, because while there would continue to be arms production and development, the decisions made in the late 1930s and the rearmament efforts of those late 1930s would largely set the course for the first few years of the war. This summary episode will focus on the impact that the Versailles Treaty had on German rearmament, the rearmament efforts of the three primary German armed forces, and then the general state of those rearmament efforts and the German economy in 1939 when the war started. As with everything related to interwar Germany, a conversation about Germany's rearmament efforts during the 1930s has to start, at least in some ways, with the Treaty of Versailles. As a part of the treaty, the German military almost ceased to exist, with only a small number of troops allowed for internal stability and policing. Along with the dismantling of its military, there were also many different types of modern military hardware that Germany was no longer allowed to build and would not be allowed to build in the future. Most importantly of these were tanks, military aircraft, and submarines. All of these restrictions were combined to completely shake up the views of the German military during the 1920s. It was forced to plan for the possibility of a defensive war with its meager resources, which in retrospect might have been a good thing, because it forced Germany's military leadership to rethink conflict in a way that some other nations would not during those years. Even with these plans, there was always an eye to the future, and to a time when the shackles of Versailles would be lifted from the German military, and it could pursue rearmament programs once again, and so efforts were constantly being made to circumvent those shackles. The German government would partner with the Soviet Union to help both nations push forward tank development at a base near Kazan in the Soviet Union. This allowed the Germans to get some practice with armored vehicles and begin to work out their armor theory, and it allowed the Soviet Union to benefit from German technical knowledge. This cooperation would eventually break down, but only when both sides felt that they did not need the assistance of the other any longer. Along with this illicit training in the Soviet Union, there were efforts as early as 1926 to begin to design and develop a new generation of tanks, using the codename Großtraktor, which is just large tractor in German. There were also efforts to build a smaller and lighter tank using Lecktraktor, or light tractor. The design and development of these early armored vehicles were important steps on the path to the panzers of the late 1930s. For military aircraft, the method of circumvention generally revolved around training of future pilots through the use of gliding schools around Germany and commercial airlines. In the modern day, the design and development of commercial and military aviation has sort of greatly diverged, but in the interwar period, the overlap was much more pronounced. This meant that German pilots who were flying commercial aircraft could very easily transition into light and medium bombers when the war started. Now, there was no official German Air Force, of course not, that would be illegal. But there were efforts to work with German airline companies to ensure that the correct pilots were chosen and that, you know, they were the best ones for the future of German aviation. Another major area of circumvention was around submarines. Given their role during the First World War, the reason that Germany was not allowed to build submarines is somewhat obvious. But they would still work to get around those limitations throughout the 20s and 30s. The major way that this was accomplished was through the use of a new company created in the Netherlands, which acted as a design office for Krupp, the German arms manufacturer. This new company worked on designs and even sold some to other nations, which gave them an excuse to test those designs. Efforts would also be made in the early 1930s to prepare for the return of rearmament by building up all of the pieces that Germany would need to commission new U-boats, allowing for a quick burst of construction as soon as the Anglo-German Naval Arms Treaty was signed, which allowed for Germany to begin to expand its navy. In all of these cases and others, the goal was always to do everything possible to prepare Germany for a return to military industrialization, without openly breaking any of the agreements made in the treaty, due to the fears that breaking the Versailles Agreement would result in military conflict that the German military was simply unable to be ready for during this time because of the restrictions of that treaty. This hesitancy to publicly go against the Treaty of Versailles would continue until 1933, when a man called Adolf Hitler would come to power in Germany. Now obviously, Hitler coming to power had many ramifications for the future of Germany, but around rearmament, his most important contribution was simply not caring about the limitations placed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles. For Hitler, rearmament was one of the most important things that Germany had to do immediately. No matter what it meant, no matter what it did to foreign relations, rearmament was key. Here are his own words, quote, "The future of Germany depends exclusively and only on the reconstruction of the Wehrmacht. All other tasks must cede precedence to the task of rearmament. In any case, I take the view that in future, in case of conflict between the demands of the Wehrmacht and demands of other purposes, the interests of the Wehrmacht must, in every case, have priority." End quote. Over the first several years that Hitler was in power, the amount of military spending in Germany would skyrocket, with the total government spending increasing by 70% by 1935. With most of that increase going to the military. The spending would be so large that it would require entirely new ways of financing spending because the German government would not until 1935 acknowledge publicly that they were entering into rearmament programs. This forced them to use a fun system of finance that was complicated. But really, it was just a system that worked on government credit, with Germany's largest industrial firms like Krupp or Rheinmetall working on credit with the assurance from the government that they would repay their money in 5 years, with interest. These accounting games could only conceal Germany's actions for so long, and on March 16, 1935, the German rearmament programs and the reintroduction of German conscription was publicly announced to Germany and the world. A critical part of all of the rearmament discussions in Germany, and in other nations during the 1930s, was when each nation planned on fighting a war. This decision was crucial for a nation like Germany, which was almost certainly going to instigate a war by its own actions. The reason that this decision was so critical is that during the early part of a rearmament plan, when the war is still many years into the future, the most important thing to spend money on is actually infrastructure. Raw material processing, factories, machine parts, design, testing, everything that has to happen before a weapon is actually manufactured for the military. All of this early spending helps to expand the capacity of the nation so that it could later start churning out military goods when it's really required, immediately before and after the start of a war. Many of the decisions taken in German rearmament during the mid-1930s was, in theory, based around an idea that the war would not be fought until at least the early 1940s, giving the German economy plenty of time to prepare itself. This timeline of war starting in the early 1940s would inform the creation of the first German four-year plan, which was announced by Hitler in September 1936. This wide-ranging plan had a few important pillars that it hoped would assist to sort of kickstart Germany's rearmament efforts. The most important was that all domestic production should be maximized to reduce the need for foreign imports. This included a tremendous amount of German spending on industries that were critical to the German rearmament and war efforts, but had been underdeveloped due to cost. The most famous of these, and perhaps the one that paid off the most, was the amount of money put into the production of synthetic oil and rubber, a process that was possible through the use of coal and a very specific bit of processing, but it was ruinously expensive to actually do. And so investment in the process had been tiny because it was cheaper just to import the oil. By pouring government funds into various industries to reduce the reliance on foreign imports, there was more foreign exchange available to import goods that Germany could not in any way produce domestically, like more food or other raw materials. The injection of funding into various industries saw German rearmament begin to rapidly increase, but it would also become a showcase for what was ultimately wrong with these efforts. Throughout the four-year plan, the mantra was there was no price ceiling. Anything that could be done should be done regardless of the cost. This is great in theory, but in reality, there is a limit on the amount of resources available, and removing any cost ceilings meant that the resources available were not always used as wisely as possible. It also meant that instead of a thoughtful plan that tried to take available resources and maximize their utility to the German military, the German rearmament efforts became an uncoordinated battleground between the various German military services as they all tried to outdo one another with massive plans for expansion, each of which would often call for more steel and oil and other materials than Germany produced in an entire year. These massively inflated estimates or massively inflated plans then tried to fight with one another for which was the most important and which should receive that steel or that oil, but they would never receive enough to actually achieve their goals. Circling back to when the war would be fought, though, the problem for German rearmament efforts is that many of the plans put in place in 1937 and 1938 would not be complete until 1942. It was only then that the German armed services felt that they would be ready to fight a war. This gave them time and resulted in a lot of effort and resources being put into slightly longer-term projects like production capacity and new manufacturing methods, rather than just churning out equipment, which probably would have been best for the German war efforts in 1939 through about 1941. Of course, this criticism only works in hindsight, because they did not know that the war was going to start in September 1939, although the fact that German rearmament efforts were just getting started by that time maybe should have caused Hitler to be a bit more cautious in his decision-making, but that just wasn't his style. Today's podcast is proudly sponsored by Fold 3, the web's premier collection of military records that helps bring the events of World War II history to life. Immerse yourself in over 670 million records as you explore photographs, individual service records, formerly classified military documents, and more. Learn how the greatest generation's triumphs and sacrifices impacted history as you take a front row seat to epic tales of courage, sacrifice, resilience, and valor. Have a veteran in your family? On Fold 3, you can combine records found on the site with what you have in your own albums and shoeboxes to create an online memorial for someone who served. Discover your military ancestors today at fold3.com. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. The Luftwaffe would be in a very good position to take advantage of German rearmament efforts to build up its strength during the 1930s, thanks mostly to the position that Goering played in the rearmament projects. He was very influential. However, they would have some challenges of their own that would have important ramifications on the events of the war years. Now, on the positive side, by the late 1930s, the Germans already had some of the best aircraft in the world. the BF-109, the HE-111, the slightly aging JU-87 Stuka are just some of the examples of the aircraft that were at or near the best in the world at what they were supposed to be doing. Many of these aircraft were introduced early enough to build into large numbers before the war, with the BF-109 being the last of those three to be introduced into military service, and that was in 1937. This provided German manufacturers years to build and improve these aircraft, and years for pilots to provide feedback for improvements, feedback that was punctuated by the use of Luftwaffe resources during the Spanish Civil War. All of the aircraft that were available in 1938 were going to be built in massive numbers, or at least that was the plan, to then be joined by some of the next generation of designs, like the Ju-88 medium bomber. In 1938, the plans were to build upwards of 7,000 of these new medium bombers, with the goal of having 21,000 aircraft in total ready for action by 1942. However, there's a certain unreality in these plans in 1938. The numbers that the Germans were shooting for were massive, and also largely unattainable for the Luftwaffe. They simply needed more factories and more raw material, with steel being one of the limiting factors given how sought after it was by all of the German armed forces. This put the Luftwaffe in an awkward spot in 1938, just a year before the war, because during that year, the number of military aircraft that were produced in Germany actually dropped from 1937. There simply were not enough resources to go around, and so the Luftwaffe found it hard to meet its targets or even meet its previous year's output. But this was also kind of a blessing in disguise, although they probably didn't think of it that way at the time, because more aircraft would have required even more fuel to keep them in the air, and that's aviation fuel, and that was hard to come by in Germany. If the Luftwaffe had reached some of Hitler and Goering's loftier expansion goals by, say, 1942, it would have required a large portion of all of the world's production of aviation fuel. And Germany only had access to a very small percentage of that total output. Now, outside of just cranking out aircraft, there were two important decisions that would be made around the Luftwaffe in the years running up to the war. The focus that it had as an institution on always prioritizing frontline strength, and the decision not to pursue a heavy bomber program. Due to the very lofty goals that the Luftwaffe leaders had in terms of the number of aircraft that they wanted, during 1938 and 1939, there was a growing disconnect between what they wanted and what was actually rolling off the assembly line. To try and close this gap, there was a reduced emphasis on stockpiling spare parts for the machines that were available. This had the short-term benefit of increasing the number of frontline aircraft available, but reduced the ability of those aircraft to be consistently combat capable over the course of a long campaign. This issue was not really felt during the first campaigns of the war, just because they were not long enough to make mechanical issues a large enough problem. But it would, come the Battle of Britain, be a serious challenge. The other problem would be a similarly long-term one, and that was the lack of a four-engine heavy bomber. Germany's missing strategic bomber is a much-discussed problem that the Luftwaffe had during the war, particularly due to there being two scenarios where it really would have come in handy: the Battle of Britain, and the attack on the Soviet Union. During the years before 1936, they were working on such aircraft, with both Dornier and the DO-19 and Junker and the Ju-89 being prototypes of a four-engine heavy bomber, much like what the Americans or the British were building at this time. These aircraft were held back by engine problems, with the engines available being neither powerful nor reliable enough to fit the bill. It's very likely that these engine issues would have been solved at some point, but in June 1936, Germany's greatest strategic bombing advocate, General Walter Wever, would die in a flying accident. The removal of such a high-placing voice for strategic bombing resulted in a re-emphasis on the Luftwaffe's medium bombing capability, which would serve it well early in the war. In my opinion, this problem, this strategic bomber problem, is probably overemphasized when looking at the performance of the Luftwaffe during the war, particularly as it related to bombing campaigns. Because as it would be shown during the Allied bombing campaigns of Germany during the war years, to execute an effective strategic bombing campaign, an Air Force had to drop a lot of bombs on the enemy. Just unbelievable amounts of explosives. And I don't think the Luftwaffe would have ever been able to build up the required number of strategic bombers to find success because they would have needed such a huge volume of bombs. That would have required a huge effort from the German armament industries that I don't think they would have done even if they would have had a four-engine heavy bomber. While the Luftwaffe was having challenges meeting some of its very lofty rearmament goals, the German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, was having some challenges meeting any of its goals. The core problem for the Kriegsmarine was the disconnect between the resources that it had available to it and its goals as a military force. During the mid-1930s, Admiral Raeder and the other leaders of the Navy would choose to pursue a very orthodox path towards rearmament. This meant building big ships with big guns, just like other navies had been doing for over 50 years. This would result in the famous German ships of the war years, the Gneisenau, the Scharnhorst, the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, all very famous ships. However, it also presented a rearmament challenge, because if the Germans really did want to challenge the Royal Navy on the high seas, they needed a lot of ships, and those would take time and a lot of steel to build, both of which the Navy was very short of. The lack of resources did not prevent major plans from being put in place for the expansion of the Kriegsmarine, though, with the expansion plan that would be put in place right before the war being called Plan Z. Plan Z was enacted on April 28, 1938, and it sought to achieve nothing short of making Germany one of the world's preeminent naval powers. Over the course of 6 years, if Plan Z would have been completed, Germany would build four H-class battleships, which would be even larger than the Bismarck class, four new and improved Panzerschiff ships, which would improve upon the Deutschlands, which had already been in service for several years. There would be two aircraft carriers, four new heavy cruisers, and then a whole list of smaller ships. During the initial six-year construction window, 194 U-boats would also be built for commerce raiding. The reason that the 6 years, which would take the plan out to 1944, was so important was because it was only in 1944 that the Kriegsmarine planned to fight a war. The plan extended beyond that date, with large numbers of every ship being built over the following 4 years as well. And this was a truly massive proposed construction program. Essentially, none of it would happen. The start of the war in September 1939 derailed all of the planned construction in Plan Z, other than the continued focus on U-boats, I guess, because the Kriegsmarine shifted its focus to short-term construction projects that would meaningfully impact the course of the war in the immediate future, instead of, in a decade. Plan Z is easily the best example of how the war started before the German rearmament plans believed that it would, because even though all of the construction would quickly wind down when the war started, in just the year before the introduction of a plan and the start of the war, countless man-hours and no small amount of resources were spent on these long-term projects that would never come to fruition. There were countless areas where those resources and man-hours would have benefited German rearmament efforts, and one of those was even in the Kriegsmarine, the U-boats. The way that Raeder and the Kriegsmarine leadership treated U-boats in the years before the war is really interesting. No one could seriously doubt the ability of the U-boats to have an impact on a conflict with Great Britain, with the performance of the German submarines during the First World War showing the entire world that a concerted commerce raiding campaign could have impact. This performance would then spiral into clandestine efforts to continue to grow and evolve German submarine designs during the 1920s and 30s, through the use of shell companies, primarily in the Netherlands. But then, when it came time to actually start building U-boats, an essential part of the German war plans, the resources placed into these efforts were kind of disappointing. As soon as rearmament began, there was a quick burst of German U-boats launched, as they assembled the stockpile of pre-built sections that had been accumulated over the previous years. But then there was a major lull. In 1938, just 9 medium-sized U-boats were built, with medium U-boats being the smallest that could reach out into the Atlantic sea lanes, and sort of into the prime regions of British trade. Then, in 1939, there were initially only 12 planned for construction, although the start of the war would kind of change these plans. These were very small numbers, set against the fact that the head of Germany's submarine forces, Karl Dönitz, believed that it would take 300 U-boats to actually accomplish the goals of the fleet, which was the destruction of all British trade through the sinking of its merchant fleet. The small number of U-boats built and the relatively low priority placed on U-boat construction during the war, or at least early in the war, resulted in entire months during the first year of the conflict where there were basically no U-boats in the Atlantic shipping lanes. Overall, the Kriegsmarine rearmament efforts were incomplete and confusing. Raeder and the naval leadership believed they simply had many more years to prepare than they did, and that left them with a fleet in 1939 and 1940, which was a confusing mess of contradictions. There were dedicated surface raiders, like the Panzerschiff, but then a small number of very traditional surface ships, like the Scharnhorst class and the Hipper class heavy cruisers, that were not really designed for surface raiding. There were two very large battleships being built in the Bismarck and Tirpitz, but none to follow, which was destined to leave the German surface fleet small enough that it would always be at risk of being destroyed by the Royal Navy, without truly impacting the course of the war. Meanwhile, the one weapon that was known to be effective against British trade, the U-boats, were languishing at a lower construction priority. It is a fleet. It had ships, but that fleet did not have, I guess, a unifying vision of what it wanted to do. And it was caught in its kind of transition to being a major traditional and orthodox surface fleet, mirroring the Royal Navy, the Imperial Japanese Navy, or the American Navy. With all three of those navies possessing the resources and national focus that the Kriegsmarine would never really have access to, either before or during the war. Of the three main branches of the German military, the Army, or the Heer, was probably the best prepared for the war, as would be shown during the opening campaigns of the conflict. However, even the Army was starting to experience some challenges with its rearmament in 1939. For example, the number of machine guns ordered in 1939 actually dropped from 61,000 to 13,000 due to a shortage of material. Other weapon orders were also cut, particularly as more steel started to flow towards the Kriegsmarine and its Plan Z. The most important area for the Army, and the one that is most well known today, were, of course, the armored and motorized formations that would be such a kind of used to devastating effect in Poland and in France. The panzer divisions would become legendary due to their actions during these two campaigns, and it would be a legacy that would follow them to every major theater that they fought in for the rest of the war. But there was something very different about the early war panzer armies, and it primarily came down to the tanks. By 1945, the Germans would best be known for some truly massive, powerful tanks, the Tiger, the King Tiger, the Panther. But when the war started, their tanks looked very different, and instead of raw firepower, they primarily found success through their use of mediocre firepower, but generally high mobility. This mobility would catch their enemies off guard time and time again. When the war began, the Panzer I and Panzer II tanks were by far the most prevalent in the German armored divisions, and they were nothing like their late war relations. The Panzer I was armed only with machine guns, while the Panzer II came equipped with a 2-centimeter gun. Panzer IIIs were also present in Poland, along with a handful of Panzer IVs, but it wouldn't be until the invasion of the Soviet Union that these later models would become more numerous. I bring up these tanks just to help kind of set your mental picture correctly. Not because the presence of the lighter tanks were necessarily bad. They were very capable machines, and the German troops would use them well early in the war. The panzer divisions would be joined by several motorized divisions as well, units that made heavy use of motor transport to help keep up with the hard-charging panzers. But these motorized troops hid an important shortcoming of the German army, its general lack of motorization outside of just a few divisions. The German army would be, for most of the war, primarily be a horse-drawn and foot-marching army, outside of the relatively small number of panzer and motorized divisions. This would create many problems early in the war, due to the tendency of the more mobile units to kind of run away from their foot-slogging neighbors. It was a problem that could only be solved by more motor vehicles, primarily trucks, and there simply were not enough of them to go around. This was mostly down to a focus, or a focus, of German rearmament, which, much like for the Luftwaffe, put a heavy focus on the frontline strength of the army and its ability to execute offensives with its armored troops. During the short campaigns that opened the war, this problem would not really strongly be felt, simply because the enemies that Germany were facing would not put up the resistance required to really strain the German supply and logistics system, or the ability of those foot-slogging soldiers to keep up. But after 1941, it would be a major problem. To close out this summary, I guess the best question to ask would be, how should we evaluate the status of German rearmament at the start of the war? I think the only real answer is incomplete. The simple fact was that all of Germany's rearmament plans pointed to a war starting at a later date. None of the military services felt that they were ready in September 1939 for a war, and instead they were aiming for a point several years in the future. But those plans also were not realistic. I mean, if you look at what the Luftwaffe was planning, and the Navy, and the Army, each of them were going to need a tremendous influx of resources, which simply was impossible for Germany to attain during peacetime. Their only option was conquest. There wasn't enough steel, oil, or a whole host of other raw resources to accomplish all their goals, and in some cases, any of their goals. The combination of these massive plans that simply were not possible, and the incorrect planning around when Germany might start a war, points to a deeper problem with German rearmament. It lacked a singular, unifying, driving vision that would get the entirety of Germany's military and economy working towards one goal. When you look at the German rearmament efforts, it seems to be driven by the goal of making the most powerful military, which is too broad of a goal to be useful. Adding up all of Germany's rearmament efforts also make it clear that they were not focused on reality, because when planning for massive economic and industrial projects, it's really important to be realistic, and the German plans were not realistic. This created weird issues where some absolutely essential items were deprioritized to try and meet production goals that were impossible for other items, which were useless without the essentials, like, you know, ammunition. Germany would prove during the war that its war industries could scale up to an incredible output. But in the years before the war, due to the coordination problems and the desire to try and maintain the public quality of life that had been built up over the 1930s, the German rearmament efforts were kind of hamstrung. Fortunately for the German military, their early campaigns would pit them against enemies that were far less equipped to actually fight the war. If the Germans were less prepared than they wanted to be, they were far more prepared than the enemies that they would face, both in terms of material and also doctrine. They had the best idea of how to fight a war in 1939. And this would hide many of Germany's military rearmament flaws during the early years of the war. But in 1941, boy, the pendulum would really swing the other way.